It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein, and this is Spy Talk.
There's a man who leads a life of danger.
Oh yeah, there are secret agent men leading lives of danger. If there's a rock hit about CIA women leading lives of danger, I don't know what it is, even after consulting a list of 42. That's 42 spy-related pop tunes. My guest today, Laura Thomas, would prefer that that hit list look a little bit different by now, decades after women have risen to leadership roles at the CIA. A former agency case officer and chief of base herself, who led sensitive CIA programs at headquarters and abroad in multiple international assignments, Thomas served for over 15 years in various national security and leadership roles across the intelligence community, including the White House National Security Council, the State Department, DOD, and, of course, with friendly foreign spy services. What caught my eye recently, though, was a cautionary piece Laura wrote on her Substack page called Espionage is a Man's World, Sex, Lies, and the CIA. Laura Thomas, welcome to Spy Talk. It's such a pleasure to have you here. You recently wrote a piece on your Substack page called Espionage is a Man's World. Clearly a double entendre there, a little bit of irony, because you enumerated the many pitfalls for women at the CIA, but you also encouraged women to join CIA. So unravel the contradictions for us there, please.
Well, I mean, espionage is truly still a man's world because most assets or spies, people that one would recruit, are still men because men hold most of the positions of power, especially in foreign adversarial countries. But I think as a female, you know what, we grew up in a man's world for the most part. And so we learn how to navigate it in ways that I think are quite unique many times to women. And I think it generally sets us up to be quite good at learning the traits of being a successful case officer.
Mm-hmm. And to make it clear for people who don't quite understand the espionage game, we're looking for people who have information. That's what we're looking for. We want to recruit foreigners who have access to information, not just foreigners.
Right.
And there's a lot of walk-ins. There's a lot of volunteers that just show up at American embassies or drop a note to CIA saying, I have information. Often it's false. They want to make a little money off CIA or whatever, or infiltrate CIA. So the main job of a CIA officer in recruiting people overseas is to find somebody with information, access to defense secrets, military secrets, diplomatic secrets, somebody close to, say, the certain guy in the Kremlin. And these are, for the most part, men.
That's right. Yeah. And not only should they have access, they should have the traits that would make them good agents. We don't necessarily want to recruit just anyone who has secrets. We want to recruit someone with secrets who has the capacity to engage in a secret relationship and do so successfully without being discovered.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write that misogynist men at CIA argue that women can't operate in places like the Middle East, where women can't leave the home without a male relative or family member accompanying them. But you write, for men from a culture where it is taboo to meet with a female alone outside of family members, it is a thrilling twist on traditional power dynamics to meet with a woman who speaks with the power of the U.S. government behind her, as well as cool-headed self-confidence. Can you explain that a little bit more, how that dynamic is at work?
Yeah, I think it ultimately comes down to human nature and what are the motivations that we have. You know, we have surface level beliefs. We want to do good things for our country, whether that's, you know, me, for example, in the United States, or a foreigner wants to see some change in their country to affect things in a way that they believe will be better for themselves or their family. And then there's usually beyond the surface level motivation, there's going to be a deeper personal motivation. And that goes for a case officer, but it also goes for the asset or the person we're recruiting. And that usually can be that, well, it's thrilling. You're engaged in an illicit secret relationship that you would not otherwise be able to entertain. So that there is, you know, there's an attraction to being involved in something like that.
Is it the usual case that men in such societies, let's say Cairo or Iran, they expect to have sex with you when they're meeting? Is that on their mind?
I don't think it's at the forefront of their mind. No. Generally, I've that's not been my experience. What they want is they're just curious. What is it like to meet with a U.S. government official? Perhaps this is a way that I can achieve my agenda and, you know, be able to engage with someone that I wouldn't normally be able to engage with.
And to be clear, we're not talking about meeting peasants in a wadi. We're talking about meeting senior officials or someone embedded in the technology sector of a foreign government. Are these men tend to be a little bit or more westernized, for lack of a better word?
Well, I would say, you know, CIA doesn't limit itself to the types of assets that it recruits. You know, even if someone is not necessarily in a senior government position, if they have information of extreme value to the United States and they meet the other requirements that you would have of an asset, then, you know, they would be considered a proper target. But, you know, generally are a lot of assets well-educated? Yes. Many who serve in foreign governments and senior positions, they've probably studied, you know, at least in their own country, sometimes in the West as well. But, you know, just because you've studied in one place doesn't mean you completely pick up the cultural traits of that location. I mean, think about so many Americans study abroad. That doesn't mean that we automatically adapt a cultural identity of the place that we've been, though what it does give us and what it would give an asset is, you know, a little bit more open-mindedness, at least to understand the way different parts of the world work, how to some degree people think. And it can create, you know, a level of empathy or at least baseline understanding that's very helpful in any conversation.
And, you know, perhaps you could talk about how this is a little bit of espionage inside baseball, but you want to meet people through socializing at events at, say, an embassy or in a hotel or a conference. Might be going on. Does being a woman attract special attention in those situations? Talking to, say, a diplomat from, well, let's go back to Egypt again or Iran. Does that immediately raise eyebrows that you are talking to someone like that?
Well, I think as any woman in any career, sometimes just by virtue of being in the room, you can raise eyebrows. So, you know, I don't think that that's necessarily strange. And we women generally, we learn to deal with that. You know, I think it can be to a female case officer's advantage many times. But, you know, there are certainly disadvantages too, because, if certain people are seen as talking with us, and maybe it raises the eyebrows of their colleagues. So, you know, one of the aspects of being a case officer that remains quite important is just a level of discretion, knowing when to engage somebody versus when to hold back.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we should make clear that not all your targets, potential recruits, are men. There are women in certainly in relevant positions in target countries in Iran and Russia and China and so on, that actually being a female might actually be an advantage.
Sure. Yeah. I would say it's, you know, a much smaller number, but certainly they exist too.
And yet you write in your piece that the CIA should find a way to train women in particular in certain kinds of situations they're going to encounter abroad. And I was kind of surprised in your piece that this wasn't already done, that there wasn't kind of a, not a separate track, but kind of some sort of block of instruction, formal or informal, where women teaching at the farm, the CIA's training facilities, who are veteran operatives in the field, aren't able to pass, or there's not a situation set up, a structure set up for veteran case officers like yourself to hand down the wisdom you've learned in the field working as a woman.
Yeah, and in the article I write that I do think that they at CIA should formalize some training around that. But the challenge is, you know, women are quite fearful of a lot of formality surrounding this issue, because the concern is that if people dig too deeply and understand that these are, you know, situations that women case officers face, that perhaps, you know, well-intentioned, but there's potential that opportunities could be taken away from women. And I think that would be, you know, an even worse scenario on the whole when you think about CIA and its objectives.
Could you explain that a little bit more, how opportunities would be taken away from women by a special kind of attention to their particular needs or skills that would be needed abroad?
Sure. I mean, if you know, if you were sitting in a CIA station abroad and you had a roster of different case officers that you could send to approach a specific target, and you had, you know, a fantastic female officer, but you thought that, oh, you know, she's probably, there's probably going to be made, you know, sexual advances made to her. I don't know how she's going to handle it, but I'm too afraid to ask her about that. I don't want to talk about it because maybe then I would seem, especially if I were a man, I would seem sexist. So just to make things less complicated and easier, you default to choosing a male officer. And, you know, in some cases you would choose a male officer, but I think that we have to be very careful when we make these decisions and make sure that we're being extremely thoughtful about it. And the fear is that, you know, people sometimes will just choose the easy course rather than the one that's more thoughtful and appropriate.
I thought one of the more interesting things that you said in the piece was that, as you just mentioned in passing, that liberal-minded men, for lack of a better word, fear counseling women on their particular issues in the field because they might be seen as sexist.
Yeah, and I'm not arguing that I think liberal-minded men need to counsel women in the field. I think women do a pretty good job themselves with knowing how to handle these situations and talking to each other. My point in the article is, as you said, there's not a formal mechanism by which to do so. It's all informal at this point. And, you know, there are women who are going to slip through the cracks in an informal system like that. And there should be some sort of at least discussion and training that touches upon these very real and tangible situations that I would argue that almost any female officer overseas is going to face.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I told you when we had an exchange before this recording that I have a friend who was a CIA operations officer in a Latin American country, and she was under diplomatic cover. And her problems weren't just with the locals. When she would go out at night for a meeting, fellow embassy employees who did not know that she was undercover thought she was out catting around. You know, this would not be a suspicion would be leveled at a man, I think, at all. Might raise some titters. But she going out at night to meet agents, she had to go into rumor control and deal with that in the embassy. You ever have a situation like that yourself?
No. I mean, I think fortunately, perhaps at least the people I was around, you know, times have changed a bit. No one ever suspected, at least me personally, of that. And nor did I see it. But I mean, if getting back to are women held many times to different standards than men? Yeah, of course. And I think this is not just a CIA challenge. It's a societal one. You know, sometimes we have to work twice as hard just to be seen, you know, half as good.
We have to take a quick break. We'll be back in a sec. You know, this just appalls me, frankly. I mean, I've been, you know, as you know, I was a former case officer myself. I've been writing about intelligence for 40 years. And this has been a constant. The problem, the challenges of women at CIA. And I just find it kind of tiring, I guess is the word, you know, to be talking about these issues about women in intelligence, women at CIA in 2023. I mean, are we making any progress?
Yeah, we are.
Why are we still talking about this?
Yeah, well, look, I agree. Why are we still talking about this? I guess my point is this is all across any institution, you know, government, private sector. So that, you know, that's a much larger question. To your question about has there been progress specifically at CIA? You know, when I started, I've definitely seen a shift. There are many women case officers there who flourish and are doing a fantastic job and have achieved, you know, excellent positions of authority and have had, you know, stellar impact. And
we've had a woman as CIA director.
Yeah. I mean, to the point. But, you know, structurally, are there still challenges that exist? Absolutely.
And there are several women in senior management positions at CIA now.
Exactly.
You think this problem would be done with? You know, many years ago, I wrote I did a feature. I was working at NPR at the time. This is a long time ago. And I did a feature about women becoming bartenders. I mean, yeah, it'd be hard to find a bar where there wasn't a woman behind it at this point.
Right.
And again, that was, you know, some 30 years ago, showing my age there. It just seems that with all the, you know, having had a woman run the CIA, having all these women in top management positions, that this situation in the intelligence agency, I'm not talking about working for a towing, you know, truck company. We're not talking about working for a construction company, traditionally hurly-burly, rough industries. We're talking about the elite intelligence service of the United States, and yet we're still talking about this. I'm not going to go on about this much longer, but let's tie this up. Why are we still talking about it now?
I mean, an intelligence organization reflects the country and the society that it comes from, and my overarching point would be that we, you know, we still have these challenges at a larger scale in the United States now. Having served abroad and, you know, met many different people from all different, you know, cultural backgrounds, religious backgrounds, political persuasions, you know, I think that we get a lot right in the United States too. And I think we can't forget that either.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that we need to stop and oh, just say, oh, everything's perfect? No, absolutely not. We still need to be working to change and improve things. And hold people who don't live up to the values that we claim accountable.
For sure. I mean, I hope a year from now when I call you up, I'm not going to ask you the same questions.
Yeah, I hope not.
Now, you level a more profound criticism at CIA. It has been leveled at CIA for many, many years now. that is growing increasingly risk averse. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, in my essay, you know, I refer to what I think is growing risk aversion, and I think that that reflects bureaucratic malaise. And I think in any bureaucracy, if that goes unchecked, what ultimately ends up happening is people want to brief, you know, that they did something, even if it's a marginal gain that doesn't really move the needle insofar as national security, or it's not some, you know, big win, it can still look good. So you don't have to do the same level of work or the same level of achievement in order to get career accolades or promotion. And, you know, I think that happens in a lot of places. I definitely think it has happened at CIA and needs to be addressed. And I think the best way to address it is through the promotion system that's there currently. Which officers are promoted, which officers receive assignments that are very important overseas and at headquarters.
You talk about mediocrities rising in the bureaucracy. I've heard that from many people. Why does that happen in our most elite intelligence agency?
Because at the end of the day, it's humans who work at the intelligence agency, and human nature is a very strong force.
How do you change
that? Best, we have to do our best to set up, empower people who can call it out and make hard decisions. We have to be careful not to put too much structure and process in place. And I think this is always a push and pull with any, you know, government or even big company institution. When you think about institution building, you don't want to overprescribe and account for the lowest common denominator of person who's going to make a mistake, because then you hold back everyone. But at the same time, you want to create some, you know, processes and procedures to try and standardize and promote excellence over mediocrity. And the best way to do that is to put people or empower people who have good judgment, are very thoughtful, to make hard decisions.
That's a great talking point for conventions and lectures and so on. And I don't mean to dismiss it, but it's full of generalities. Can you be more specific about, you know, we have limitations on how much you can talk about or in the way you talk about it. Can you give us an example of someone who was really a stellar operator in the field and did well in a management tour who just wasn't promoted because of whatever, this mediocrity bypassed them?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm certainly not going to be able to give you specific examples. But look, do I know of the case officers who I thought were just phenomenal? They were some of the best recruiters, and not just the best recruiters. They were some of the best thinkers and had the ability to manage people and influence organizations. But, you know, almost it was as if their star burned a bit too bright. And it was
management
seen as a threat.
Management was threatened.
Yeah, that happens. That happens in a lot of places. It happens at CIA too.
Yeah. It makes me wonder whether, let's say, the China target, which is extremely difficult. As we know, CIA has reportedly suffered some really serious, grievous setbacks in China. Would you say that CIA management is worried more about an operation being disrupted by the Chinese security services or finding out that it might leak into the papers?
I think to comment generally, CIA management is concerned that there will be another attack on American soil that they do not know about, or they do not disrupt, or that there is a longer-term threat such as China, such as, you know, Russia, that they just didn't have the beat on. At the same time, you know, going back to bureaucratic malaise, it's easy to fall into the trap of briefing incremental progress as these great wins, and I think that's one of the challenges that the agency faces these days.
I think that we saw this play out in Afghanistan, and I know that's a real sore spot for you. You've written about that, as I have, about the lack of accountability for the Afghan disaster, which was not, which just played out in the chaotic departure from Kabul that had been playing out for years and years. The military has taken a lot of blame for that. The generals who kept talking about progress in Afghanistan when they knew or should have known it, they weren't making progress. CIA has some responsibility in that?
You know, I didn't work or was not working on that topic at the time that the actual withdrawal was happening. I had already left at that point. You know, what I can say is I think that there were a lot of people on the ground who were doing everything in their power to help the right people get out of that country. And I was extremely impressed and awed by some of the efforts that people inside the Kabul airport compound, the lengths that they were going to get people on those flights.
Bill Burns, the current CIA director, who's getting a lot of high marks for his performance this day, I must say I wrote kind of a gushing piece about him when he was first nominated because I had read his memoir. And what I was struck by in his memoir was that he said he was wrong on Iraq. He should have spoken up more forcefully about the disaster that was likely to become and did become. You see any more of that institutionally around Washington? I'm sure you stay in touch with some old pals. This is an issue that's come up again. We're now in the midst of the second anniversary of the Kabul disaster. Mm-hmm. Do you sense that the CIA, among other agencies, will start, having looked at the detritus of the past 20 years, I mean, a mess. We've just left a huge mess in the Middle East, which generations will be paying for, Americans and the locals, the Iraqis, the Afghans, etc., will be paying for decades. Do you see any sense? Have you sensed any mood that, you know, we really, some sort of, you know, self-stock taking, that we've really got to do a better job of speaking truth to power?
I mean, when I was there, I think there were a lot of deep and hard conversations about accountability and how to do things differently. But I do think that we have to remember CIA is not a policy arm. CIA doesn't carry out, they don't determine policy. They try to inform policymakers. Ultimately, when you look at a lot of these decisions you're talking about, they are policy decisions. And, you know, we just look at the political environment, especially that we're in now, one that we could be, you know, that could be deteriorating even further, depending on, you know, the results of the next election and how that goes. So, as a nation, though, do I think we need to have a bit more self-introspection and be willing to admit our faults? Yes, admitting that you made a mistake is not the same as succumbing to it. And we've got to do better.
That's for sure. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about this recent leak of an intelligence assessment. It was very pessimistic about Ukrainian success against the Russians. Why was that in the paper? I mean, the reporter, John Hudson, who got is a very, very good intelligence reporter, but what do you make of that showing up on the front page of the Washington Post?
Yeah, I'm not tracking that, so I can't really comment.
But it seems to be the age-old way of waging policy battles in Washington, which is if you're not getting your way or your analysis isn't being heard, you give it to the Washington Post or the New York Times or CNN or whoever.
Yeah, and if that did happen, I think that's extremely unfortunate and not becoming of the profession of an intelligence officer or agency.
Yeah. I don't think it's a practice that's ever going to end. That's the way it goes in Washington. Let's get back, just circle up now with women at the CIA. What would you say to a woman who wants to join CIA? Offhand, in terms of joining operations or joining analysis, it's often said that women are better intelligence analysts than men are. Do you agree with that, by the way?
Look, I know so many fantastic male case officers and analysts. So I don't want to make a general comparison like that. Do I think that women have an advantage as case officers just because the way we have to, we're essentially the smaller gender in the sense of, you know, physical power. We always have to be watching our backs anywhere we go. We're walking around at night in a city. We are looking over our shoulder. We do have to look and start to assess threats that potentially could be, you know, evolving in front of us in ways that men don't always have to do. So I think we do have an advantage as a case officer for some unfortunate reasons. But for any women that are out there that are interested in CIA, absolutely, I think you should look at it as a career. It can be incredibly fulfilling. You get to see what's going on behind the headlines. You get to do a job that, one, you're doing something in support of your country and the people in your country. But it's also, from a personal standpoint, it's incredibly fulfilling. You're mm-hmm. essentially going out and recruiting spies. They're, you know, the movies get a lot wrong, but they get some things right. There's fun involved in the job. And for any young woman out there, you know, organizations like the CIA or any other intelligence arms within the U.S. government, they really need young women to step up and be the next generation of officers that recruit the best sources that hopefully give us the information we need to prevent wars or to at least win them really quickly when they start.
There's not many jobs where you potentially can affect the course of human events.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I mean, you get a right piece of information or thwart an adversarial operation, you can change the course of U.S. foreign policy, a course of war and peace. Not many jobs hold that opportunity.
No, they don't. But the challenge therein lies that, you know, you're still not a policymaker. So while you can be very close and see how policy is being made, you can provide the information, and perhaps you have your own personal viewpoint of what decisions should be made. It's not yours to make. So it is a struggle to have to see, you know, sometimes the policy decisions certainly do not work out in the way that you think that they should. And that can be a struggle. So you have to be able to make peace with that as well.
Well, that's true in any corporate environment, I would say. No. Mm-hmm. Like changing a global brand from Twitter to X.
Right. Yep.
Anyway, Laura Thomas, it's so generous of you to spend this time with us, and really appreciate it. I urge everyone listening to read your Substack page, Action Line. It's terrific and really informative. You really want to know what an informed insider knows about the intelligence world and working in intelligence, I urge you to read Laura's Substack page. So until the next time, thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you so much, Jeff.
And that's it for another week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete archive at the MSW Network or on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And do please leave us a comment, good or bad. We love hearing from listeners. And if you haven't already, do check out the Spy Talk news site on Substack, where our deeply experienced contributing writers offer a steady diet of scoops and original analysis. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. Oh, and by the way, that recording of Secret Agent Man, listeners of a certain age know that's Johnny Rivers, of course. The record came out in 1966, a time when Sean Connery was reigning as James Bond and Cold War spy thrillers were just getting traction. A lot of water under the bridge since then. That's it. Thanks for listening. I'm Jeff Stein. This has been Spy Talk. See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, high up MAGA guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they
are.
Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.